I'm Rachel from Miami Beach. You're listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Here's Tom Hudson.
Thanks, Rachel. We appreciate your help this week on our special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup. Great to have you along. We're going to start this week by talking about the political turmoil that continues in Venezuela, and it's intensifying over this last week. Earlier this week, officials loyal to President Nicolas Maduro stripped opposition leader Juan Guaido of immunity. That means Guaido could face prosecution and arrest in Caracas. In January, Guaido declared himself Venezuela's interim president. More than 50 countries, including the United States, have recognized him as such. Now, all this happening while the country suffers from one of the worst humanitarian crises. And this week, the United States Senate is debating a multi-$100 million humanitarian aid package. Guaido's wife, Fabiana Rosales, visited Florida this week. She was in Tallahassee alongside Governor Ron DeSantis.
Hoy la vida del venezolano corre peligro.
Today, Venezuelans live in danger.
Hoy la vida del presidente de Venezuela, Juan Guaidó, corre peligro.
Today, the life of the president of Venezuela, Juan Guaidó, is in danger.
Local story with obviously a foreign implication, but it is a story in our backyard, in our front yard, in our neighborhoods, in our own homes, and with our friends and family here in South Florida. And the South Florida Roundup, your experiences with friends or family, business associates in Venezuela. What are you hearing out of the country? What are you experiencing in your own area? You can send us a text today on the South Florida Roundup, 786-786-7636. What do you want to know about the situation in Venezuela and the continued relations and pressure, international pressure building on Nicolas Maduro? 786-786-7636 is the text line. Our America's correspondent Tim Padgett is back with us on the Roundup. So, Tim, first let's start here in South Florida with the interim First Lady.
Right.
A bit of a strange title to begin with, but that's right. Where we are with politics when it comes to Venezuela. Fabiana Rosales, what was the purpose of her visit to South Florida and to Florida?
I think the main purpose was just to keep galvanizing support here amongst this very large and very important diaspora, Venezuelan diaspora, to keep that energy up. And she was very warmly received. And then not just by the Venezuelan community. She also visited, for example, the Shrine of the Virgin of Charity, the Cuban congregation,
because they
feel very much in solidarity with her. And she's very soft-spoken, but a very strongly spoken young woman. She's only 26 years old. And I remember when I asked her, are you worried now that your husband could be arrested any day? Because the regime has been arresting other people around him. She says, no, every time they arrest one of the people around him, it just makes his resolve stronger.
Mm. Her trip here in Florida was interesting because of the itinerary. The piece of sound we heard, for instance, was her standing with Governor Ron DeSantis, not right here in South Florida, not in Doral, but in Tallahassee, in the seat of state government.
Because she knows how important not just the diaspora here in South Florida is, but how important the politicians all over Florida are. She knows that people like DeSantis are conduits between the diaspora here and the very important people in Washington making the decisions on how we're pressuring this regime.
So with that in mind, what is the latest on the relations and the pressure that the United States is trying to continue to apply and increase in Caracas and Venezuela?
Well, as you mentioned, the Senate is now debating whether to send almost $500 million down to Venezuela in humanitarian, desperately needed humanitarian aid.
Which represents twice what some of the Florida delegation had been talking about $200 million, now up to $400 million. Where did that increase come from? What does that tell us about some of that engagement?
I think in the past couple of weeks, you have seen the situation get more dire in Venezuela with these epic power outages and water shortages. You have people going through power outages, not for hours, but for days right now, and not just in Caracas, all over the country. It is wreaking havoc on their lives. Not only that, but as I mentioned, the water shortages. You have people out on the streets looking for any any source of potable water that they can find. And this is really upping the stakes of this humanitarian crisis. And I think that's one of the reasons we're seeing more intense aid from the Senate being debated.
Meantime, Guaido, as you mentioned, the pressure even from the Maduro regime inside Venezuela, obviously increasing and intensifying on Guaido and his inner circle. It's touched his inner circle. Right. There have been folks within that circle that have been detained, if not arrested. More suspicion even today on this Friday as we're talking about Maduro potentially moving against Guaido, as we expect street protests this weekend, right?
And I think this all has to do with what I was just talking about, the power and water outages. Mm. The regime, Maduro and the regime, are getting really spooked by the public outcry over this. And so as a result, they're getting more spooked by Guaido's influence over the public. A month ago, I was saying on this show that I didn't think the regime, would, at least in the short term, would move to arrest Guaido because of the international pressure that would throw down him. Unfortunately, the short term has gotten a lot shorter because of this power and water disaster. And so they're getting very panicked in the regime, and that's making it, unfortunately, more likely that he could be arrested. Because of his influence over people there, and as you just mentioned, because he's also calling for even more massive marches to protest the regime this weekend.
What's the scale that those marches could be? Have we seen it before?
Yes, I think we have seen before, but it won't be so much the size that will really panic the regime. It'll be the anger. Mm. The anger volume could be turned up because the suffering has been turned up there.
In the meantime, international pressure, is that continuing to build within the hemisphere as well?
Yes and no. Okay. I think we're seeing countries like the Lima Group, this congregation of Latin American countries that have unusually banded together to pressure Maduro. We're not really seeing them, coming out as vocally as they were, say, a month, two months ago. And I think that's beginning to worry Washington.
What's behind that reticence, do you think?
A lot of it, unfortunately, has to do with the Trump administration itself. It has been so vocal in terms of threats of things like military intervention, and that is causing a lot of the Latin American governments to back off.
You know, weeks ago when Vice President Pence visited Colombia and spoke about the situation with Maduro, he had talked about the Maduro regime having would be out of power soon.
Yeah.
Trying to put a definitive time frame on that has been very vague. The administration has been vague, and its supporters have been vague. Mario Diaz-Balart, the congressman who's been one of the point people in Venezuela, has been confident that it will happen soon, but not really putting the expectation of a specific time frame on it.
Yeah, the problem is that the Latin American countries, they want to put pressure on Maduro for sure, but they want this also to be a negotiated settlement. They want the Maduro regime to come to the table and concede that we have to have new elections, for example, in Venezuela. They see that message being contradicted by this more belligerent, bellicose, military intervention is still an option on the table, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. They see that themselves being contradicted by that, and I think that's causing a little bit of a disconnect right now.
Tim Padgett, our America's correspondent here at WLRN. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
Lots more to come here on the special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup. A hunger strike in Miami ends after 3 weeks. Did it work? What was accomplished? That's coming up on the Roundup after this.
I am Evangelina Altamirano in Miami Springs, and you're listening to the South Florida Roundup with Tom Hudson.
Evangelina, thank you so much for your help here on this special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup. Just a great example of how we can't do this kind of program without your support. Today, it's everything from your pledge to, of course, you helping us get back into the program, Evangelina. Thanks so much. All right, let's talk about a hunger strike in Miami's Liberty City neighborhood. It was in the headlines over the past month or so. It came to an end a week ago. For 3 weeks, 9 men set up a large tent and slept in a vacant lot. They were calling attention to gun violence that disproportionately impacts black neighborhoods in Miami. The 9 men became known as the Hunger Nine. Leroy Jones is one of the Hunger Nine. His stepson was killed in a shooting, and he says he's doing it for all families that have been touched by gun violence.
It's bigger than just my family. You know, I grew up in neighborhoods like this. So to watch this happen and the way it's been happening in the last 10 years or so is, you know, is really heartbreaking.
So what was the experience of gun violence that these folks experienced? What about your own experience of gun violence here in South Florida? Perhaps you know some of the Hunger Nine. Maybe you saw some of those folks out protesting gun violence, trying to bring awareness to gun violence. You can send us a text today on the South Florida Roundup. The text line is open at 786-786-7636. 786-786-7636. WLRN's Nadege Green is with us here on the Roundup. Nadege, before we talk about ending this hunger strike, what was the scene like? What was that like, and who was there, both invited and just stopping by?
It was interesting. You saw a wide range of people from across our community end up on 62nd and 12th in Liberty City. So people like the mayor, various mayors and political officials from across municipalities stopped by. Congresswoman Frederica Wilson came by. Trayvon Martin's parents stopped in. But you also had everyday community members, neighbors who live across the street. While I went there about two or three times, and you know, people would drive by and honk their horns, mm-hmm. or they would see the sign and pull over and shout to the men, like through the fence, like, good job. Thank you so much for doing this. We're so happy you're talking about this. And so you just saw a wide segment of our community show up. And there were these conversations that happened. I went there a few days after our story ran, and apparently some of our listeners showed up to the Hunger Nine. They said, we heard this story on WLRN, and some of our listeners went, and there was a woman who heard it on WLRN, and she brought flowers so she could put, there's a clothesline that was a memorial, a remembering spot where parents were hanging memorial T-shirts of their children who were killed by gun violence, and she wanted to come to place flowers there.
For the Hunger Nine, what was their personal experience with gun violence that motivated them?
A wide range. I mean, many of these are Black men who are from communities like Liberty City. Some of them are from Liberty City or Perrine or Gules. You know, they work in our community. Leroy Jones works in our community, does a lot of work with the county, actually, for job employment. And the Circle of Brotherhood itself is an entity in Liberty City that works towards economic development, and they do mentorship and all kinds of community empowering workshops in Liberty City. And one of the Hunger Nine, Albert Campbell in particular, talked about his personal role in the community.
I'm one of the brothers that have done some things in this community that keeps me up at night. I haven't killed anyone, but I don't know if the poison that I sold to our people led to somebody doing something to get drugs.
So Albert was actually arrested for nonviolent drug offenses and he was serving about 35 years in prison when his sentence was commuted by Barack Obama by about 10 years. And so he was like, now that he's had the opportunity to come back into the community, he wants to do good. He wants to almost repay the community that, in his own words, he may have helped destroy in some ways.
We are talking about the Hunger Nine, nine gentlemen who were on a hunger strike for 3 weeks before ending a week ago in Liberty City, bringing awareness to gun violence in that neighborhood, but all across Miami and South Florida. Maybe you have some experience with gun violence. Share that with us via text at 786-786-7636. The text line again, 786-786-7636. WLRN's Nadege Green is still with us. Hunger strike is some would say just an extreme measure. I mean, to deprive oneself of sustenance and for 3 weeks at this. Why did they take this step? And tell us about that decision to bring it to an end.
They said that they wanted to take this step because they felt that this would get people talking and to actually physically put their bodies on the line. Because then what we're talking about is actually something very physical, right? Someone getting shot. And when we talk about the trauma from gun violence and what you feel, it's not just, you know, when you get shot, but really how this impacts a community at large. What does it mean to live in a community that's constantly under siege by gun violence? It means that some kids don't sleep next to windows because their parents are afraid they'll get shot. It means that, you know, that they can't ride their bicycles outside, or that their parents, who are always grieving, they can't walk down the same street anymore because their kid, you know, was under a tarp on that same street mm-hmm. after they were shot. And so it was almost bringing this very physical awareness to what happens when gun violence occurs and to also make a personal sacrifice as they talk about this.
And the decision to end after 3 weeks, as you mentioned, the motivation was awareness. It certainly was that. A lot of local media covered it. We covered it here on WLRN. It was certainly noteworthy, but it did get national and some international attention as well.
Absolutely. And I think this is what they wanted. They wanted to have a conversation, and we don't know what will come of it yet. I definitely will follow up because I know when I was out there, Deputy Mayor Maurice Kemp with Miami-Dade County, mm-hmm. he was there and he talked to me briefly about some of the steps the county is taking to address gun violence and that they actively plan on working with the Circle of Brotherhood as well, because they recognize that government can't fix this alone. You need community partnerships. You need all the various pieces in our community. We're always talking about the education sector, health, government, individual community, that this is a multi-layered issue. And so he did talk a bit about that. So it's just a matter of seeing what happens next.
And so the decision to end this, what was driving that? It ended on Friday, a week ago. Were they satisfied? Were the Hunger Nine satisfied with this conversation that they sparked?
I think so. I absolutely think that they were satisfied. And one of the things that they mentioned is that what really made their hearts happy were seeing the young people who came through, because they wanted to make clear that this isn't just about, victims and the people who've been shot, but this was also about to reach the people who were doing the shooting. And so it is very real that on that lot, you had individuals who may have shot at folks in the community sitting down, talking to them and themselves. And a few of them have admitted that they themselves, have held guns and have done things in the community. So having a conversation that does not exclude the people who actually shoot, because they recognize that's a conversation that needs to happen as well. And that did happen.
A couple of texts here coming in. One from 561 area code. I commend the men who did the Miami hunger strike for helping bring awareness to gun violence. I lost my niece in the Parkland shootings to gun violence. Gun violence has no color boundaries. Since then, my husband and I have joined Moms Demand Action to help try for change and stand with Parkland. Any movement in the right direction is a good thing. Keep up the work, gentlemen. God bless, says the 561 texter.
And there are also, I think there were two groups from Parkland that came down to meet with the Hunger Nine. Actually, on the anniversary of March for Our Lives, some students from Parkland met with the Hunger Nine in Liberty City as well.
Another text from 954. I don't understand why they would, why they were doing it, to what they were trying to accomplish. Everybody knows gun violence is starving themselves. Starving themselves can't possibly help anyone. The criticism that nine people on a corner in Miami can accomplish what? Sheer scale of the problem.
I mean, you have to start somewhere, right?
Yeah.
And I think what the Hunger Nine did do was create a community meeting space, because there are plenty of people in the community who don't go to City Hall, who don't go to County Hall. But it's very real that if you lived across the street from 62nd and 12th, you were in that same lot with your mayor. You were in that same lot with a city official. There were plenty of police departments that also came. There were police cadets, police in training who were there. And so now you have this community meeting ground. So it's meeting people where they are and not making them necessarily come to you. So that did happen.
And it was a purposeful location, that specific location, that they decided to have this hunger strike in a very public way.
Right. That location means a lot. On 62nd and 12th, for example, it's right across the street from the Liberty Square housing projects where so many shootings happen. Catty corner to that is the Sherdavia Jenkins Park 9-year-old who was killed by gun violence in Liberty Square. It's a memorial park for her. And about across the street from there is Mount Calvary Missionary Baptist Church, where many of the funerals happen for victims of gun violence in the neighborhood. So it's almost like a corner that has witnessed the gun violence in the community. Like, this is the intersection of that, whether it's police cars going by, the ambulances that are picking people up, or the actual structures around it. This is an area. I mean, I covered a mass shooting in Liberty City just one block away from there, where eight people were shot, two died.
Yeah.
And so in right where you are, you can actually see many of the teddy bear memorials, which marks where someone died. And so I think it was a very strategic corner, because that corner has seen a lot of death.
And talk a little bit about that, about how this changes the tenor of literally that street, that corner that has seen so much death and destruction.
I think it's activating the space around this, right? It's again saying that meet people where they are. If this is where an issue is, like, let's bring the resources to where the issues are and not always rely on people to, again, show up at County Hall or City Hall, because if you were on your way to work, you could stop by on 62nd and 12th if you're in that neighborhood. If you're coming from school, it didn't require for you to leave your neighborhood to talk about the issues that are impacting your neighborhood.
Had these gentlemen, these Hunger Nine, had they been known to do public advocacy? Had they?
Absolutely. They're all part of the Circle of Brotherhood, and that's what the Circle of Brotherhood does. You know, they work out of, the name escapes me, but I know it's named after Dorothy Bendross Mindegall. It was an old school board member. They pretty much turned an old school in Liberty City into a community center. And in that center, there are all kinds of activations and programs and activities that happen there. And the Circle of Brotherhood is central to that in the programming and most of the stuff happening there.
Any other type of activation like this that they want to do in the future? Do you know if this is a kind of public display of... It's not protest necessarily, but just awareness.
I'm sure they'll be working along this. I don't know what the next public facing thing that they're doing, but I know that this is a group that is embedded in the community. And also because they were centered in Liberty City, mm-hmm. I just want to make it clear that the conversation they were having was countywide. Yeah. So they were talking about gun violence in Miami Gardens, Perrine, Ghouls, Homestead as well. In fact, some of the Hunger Nine are from South Dade too.
And that's an important piece here, right? While the location of this was specific, it really was to draw attention to the fact that gun violence is something that is in multi-neighborhoods.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Nadej Green with WLRN. Thanks so much for sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you for having me,
Appreciate
Tom.
Appreciate it. Plenty more to come here on this special Pledge Edition. Stick with us. Corals across South Florida's coast. They're dying off to disease. Scientists moving to try to save and store them for the future. That's next on the South Florida Roundup.
Hi, I'm Rachel from Miami, and we're actually at Vice City Bean in Miami, and you're listening to South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Here's Tom Hudson.
All right, Rachel, thanks so much. Be sure to have a double shot of Java for us there at Vice City. Great to have you along. Rachel, just one of the many folks that help us here during a special pledge edition of the South Florida Roundup, and of course, it's you, the listener, that really makes all of this possible here on WLRN. Biologists in the Florida Keys are racing to save colonies of corals. Disease is wiping them out, spreading like wildfire underwater, biologists say. Scientists say they're losing 95% of these corals along the coast, stretching from Martin County up north all the way through South Florida down to the Keys. State biologist Rob Ruzica is one of the leaders of the Coral Rescue Project. The other aim of this project is to breed the corals once they're in captivity.
We are scientists, so we're used to measuring things, documenting how they're doing. But the actual removal process and then putting them into captivity and then driving these corals around the state of Florida is all very new to us.
The coral activity is awfully important for South Florida. The coral reef, a big piece of the ecosystem that makes South Florida so special, and obviously plays a big role when it comes into storm season here in the region as well. So we're going to be talking about the race to save colonies of corals off the shores of South Florida. Have you experienced them out snorkeling or scuba diving? You can tweet us at WLRN. You can also send us a text, 786-786-7636. Maybe you're a long-time snorkeler and you've seen the decimation that has happened in the coral reef offshore. Share those experiences with us via the text line here today, 786-786-7636. WLRN's Nancy Klinger is from our southernmost bureau at the studios of Key West. Nan, first of all, describe what this disease is. This is different than coral bleaching, something that perhaps is more commonly known, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Coral bleaching is a real problem for reefs, and especially recently in the years 2014 to 2017, we saw a massive global bleaching event. But the thing with bleaching is that some reefs can recover, at least partially. The reefs expel their algae, but they can come back. But with this disease, it kills the coral. Mm. And so when this disease is through with that particular coral head, it's gone.
So in the story that you reported this week, one of your sources described this as spreading like wildfire. And I thought, what an odd description of something that's happening, you know, several feet underwater, but
right,
but
right.
but yet very tangible, very tactical, very tactile. You can see that image in your mind that this disease is just spreading like wildfire, just floating on down the coral reef. Is that how it happens?
Yeah, I mean, it's taken a couple years. It started in 2014 off the coast right there in downtown Miami, close to where you are right now. And it's spread both north and south, as you said, up past Martin County, mm-hmm. and now it's reached Key West early this year. And it's affecting the stony corals. It's called stony coral tissue loss disease. And normally, the diseases have been known to affect things like elkhorn and staghorn, but this one is not affecting those corals. It's affecting the boulder corals, the brain coral, the star coral, the things that are really the foundation yeah. that form the framework for yeah. coral reefs.
The elkhorn and the staghorn, those are the stars of the coral reef, right? I mean, that's,
right.
that's what you want to see when you stick your face in the water along the reef. The stony corals are our foundation. It's the cement block, so to speak, of the coral reef.
Yeah, but they're pretty beautiful on their own, too.
Fair enough.
And things like pillar coral, which is pretty rare, is another one that's being affected by this disease.
And so as they die off, what does that mean? What's the risk to the reef itself?
Well, I mean, you have the sort of physical effect. If this foundation isn't there, the whole thing just can kind of crumble away. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the loss of this ecosystem is incredibly important for ecological reasons, for hurricane protection, as you mentioned, and also just for economically. I mean, the fishing and the diving and all the things that the reef brings to South Florida.
So as this disease has spread up and down the coral reef off the east coast here of South Florida, does it know no bounds? Is it, I mean, are biologists able to stop it or control it somehow?
No. And that's been one of the things that's really worrisome is, you know, we've been seeing diseases affect corals for
right.
decades here in South Florida, but they usually don't last this long. So that's one real worry. And so they were expecting maybe it would burn out faster than this. And then they were really hoping once it reached the middle keys that it wouldn't make that jump between the middle and the lower keys. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're looking at a map or a chart, that's where the keys go from running kind of north-south to east-west. And yeah. there's a big gap there. And that's the span that the 7 Mile Bridge goes across. But then it showed up in the lower keys about a year ago at Lou Key, which is one of our most prized and beautiful reefs. It's been a national marine sanctuary for decades, long before the Keys as a whole were. And that was when the scientists really started thinking, you know, we've got to do a Hail Mary here and make sure we keep some of these things alive.
And I want to ask you about what they're doing in order to save the reef. But is it important to understand where the disease came from in order to try to tackle it? Is there any kind of work that can be done along those lines?
Yeah, I think they are doing that in the labs, trying to figure out, you know, what it is and mm-hmm. what kind of treatments they can apply. And they are doing some treatments for some of the sort of most prized corals in the water that are affected that are real favorites with divers. So they'll do kind of a chiseled line to keep the disease from spreading and apply an antibiotic to that. Yeah,
like a fire.
But you can't do that to the entire reef.
No, but almost like a fire line you'd see on those wildfires that we see video of in California, for instance.
That's right.
Wow.
That's right.
And so they're also using their chisels to try to take some of the coral out of the reef in order to save them.
Yeah, they are collecting about 4,200 separate coral colonies, and they are doing that by hand, you know, selecting them, finding healthy ones, which is getting harder as this thing is spreading. So they're having to get ahead of the disease line at this point, going west of Key West. And they need to collect more than 20 different species of coral, and they want to make sure they get at least 50 different genotypes or genetic individuals, because that way they can, you know, preserve genetic diversity if they're breeding these in labs.
We're talking about a coral disease that's spreading along the coral reef just offshore in Florida. Speaking about it with our southernmost reporter, Nancy Klinginer, from the studios of Key West. If you've experienced this, you've seen this, maybe you're a snorkeler or a scuba diver, you've seen the decimation in the coral reef, you've seen bleaching, certainly. Have you seen evidence of this kind of coral reef disease? The text line is open, 786-786-7636. Again, 786-786-7636. 36. For those of us who don't spend time underwater looking at these kinds of things, Nan, what is a coral colony? And what's important about that to understand as the biologists try to figure out this disease?
Well, coral is made up of polyps, so these little tiny individual things with kind of a foot at one end and a mouth at the other. And a group of those together is a coral colony. So when you see, you know, a brain coral that looks like a big boulder with kind of waves that look like brain matter on it, that's a coral colony.
And so as the marine biologists race to try to get coral colonies that are not infected with this disease, is it important? Do they have to tackle the kind of the whole colony, or is it just pieces of it?
They're pretty much selecting whole colonies, not fragments, and they're selecting them to be between 10 and 30 centimeters because they don't want to put really big ones because they want to get a lot of them. And there's only so much room in a lab or an aquarium.
So as they put them in the lab or in the aquarium, what's the next state if they kind of clean them up and keep them going?
Yeah. First of all, keeping them alive, which is, you know, anybody who's got a saltwater aquarium can
know. It's a lot of work. Kind of, yeah.
Next is breeding them so that eventually they could repopulate the reef if this disease does eventually burn out and make sure they're still there.
Are they creating kind of a coral reef bank? Does such a thing kind of exist off the shore?
That's right. This is a gene bank for these stony corals, and it's the first time anything like this has been attempted anywhere.
And what about assistance or kind of awareness within the community there in the Keys? As you know, the reef obviously is a big magnet for tourism and hospitality.
Yeah, the Florida Keys National Marine Sanctuary has a really good page about this disease on its website, which is floridakeys.noaa.gov. And NOAA in this case is spelled N-O-A-A.
Mm-hmm.
and it's important because they want people to report where they're seeing the disease. And they also want divers and snorkelers to be really careful about not spreading the disease. Because if you have, you know, your wetsuit and your dive gear and you go from one place and then to another place that's not affected, you could actually be transporting.
Oh, is that
bacteria.
Right? So, right. Yeah. So you could kind of be a host, an unknowing host in continuing this.
That's right.
And then further along down the Key, you mentioned this thing is spread all the way from Martin County all the way down to Key West. If we continued further along the reef, is that continued at risk as you move out into the Gulf?
Yeah, and I would say the big worry is probably the tortugas because those reefs are just beautiful and protected and remote enough that they haven't suffered a lot of the impacts that some of the reefs closer to shore have. So I'm sure everybody's crossing their fingers that it won't get there. It has been reported in the Caribbean, too.
Is that right? So, Nancy Klinginer watching all things in the Keys, including coral reefs here today. She's our southernmost reporter from the studios at Key West. Thanks so much, Nan.
Thank you, Tom.
Always appreciate hearing from all of our listeners throughout the Keys and, of course, throughout Dade County, Broward County, and Palm Beach County here on this special edition of the South Florida Roundup from WLRN. Finally on the Roundup this week, paying tribute to the least poetic definition of where you live, writing an ode to your zip code. WLRN is partnering with the O Miami Poetry Festival again this April, asking you to write a poem about where you live. You say you're not a poet? Well, how about this? Use your 5-digit zip code. A zip ode is a 5-line poem using your zip code. Each digit represents how many words per line.
Hi, my name is Danielle. I live in North Miami. My zip code is 33168. And my poem is, I live on the seam of where people assume only bad things happen. You shouldn't turn there. But that's my house.
Here I am, left the hood. So why do I still miss the melody of the afilador truck?
Vivian Perez, Pinecrest, 33156.
Alan Harbater, Lauderdale Lakes, 33311. I live in a restaurant desert. Even Grubhub can hardly deliver.
My name is Rebecca, and I live in Davie. 33324. Here is my poem. All the horses and the sheep can be smelled from across the dark, wide street.
My name is Rick Carlin from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. 2 gay men, 1 tiny dog in Fort Lauderdale. Hashtag love makes the family.
And during this LGBTQ Pride Week, enjoy the Miami Beach Gay Pride Parade on Sunday. You can use our Zipode tool at WLRN.org/zipodes. The deadline to submit your own ode to your zip code is April 19th. That'll do it for our program this week, and two of our listeners, Hillary and Ryan, will help us out.
The South Florida Roundup is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Teresa Frontado is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepard.
Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. The director of radio operations is Peter J. Mertz, and WLRN's director of radio programming and the show's technical supervisor is Jason Zabka.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening and supporting WLRN.